John Batchelor is now on Facebook. Become his Facebook friend at facebook.com/Batchelor Show.
I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. My colleague and co-host Bob Zimmerman of Behind the Black joins me because we are very pleased to welcome two distinguished gentlemen whose jobs right now include one of the most challenging, and yet it requires a great deal of imagination to look into the future and consider that what has happened before to Earth will happen again, which is a near-Earth asteroid or a near-Earth object colliding with the Earth, the atmosphere or the Earth itself. The Earth is ripped with the residue, the evidence of these things happening over eons, and by that I mean hundreds of millions of years. The Earth itself is a product of the collisions of detritus, of planetesimals, of small objects, which formed the great big planet 4 billion years ago, the hot planet, as these collisions stopped. Our moon is the product, we believe, of a collision with a Mars-scale planet that hit Earth and spun off into that satellite we have today. But these are near-Earth objects being tracked all the time. And most recently, there was an opportunity for NASA to observe a comet that heretofore we'd observed from a mission in 2005, Comet Tempel 1, where there'd been impact on the comet in order to learn what it's made of and how its orbit may be affected by forces that are in the solar system. I welcome Dr. Don Yeomans, who is a fellow at the Jet Propulsion Lab. That's JPL for short. He's a senior research scientist. He's manager of NASA's Near-Earth Object Program Office and supervisor of the Solar System Dynamics Group, as well as the chairman of the Near-Earth Objects for the Space Explorers Association, Tom Jones. Tom and Don, a very good evening to you. Tom, I begin with you, because the last time we were talking that night, when we were getting Temple 1 pictures in from the flyby by NASA, what did we learn from those photographs of the comet?
Well, I think it was a great achievement by NASA to predict the face of the comet that would be facing the spacecraft. They did a great job in capturing the imagery to compare to the 2005 impact that was performed by Deep Impact. And this Stardust Next spacecraft grabbed some very crisp images today, now 6 years later, of the comet's surface, looking for the impact point from that 2005 probe. And in fact, they did detect the very subtle signature of where this copper slug slammed into Temple 1 6 years ago. And from that, we might learn a lot about the surface properties and the interior makeup of these fluffy ice balls we call comets.
Don, a very good evening to you. I see the photographs up that you can get from the NASA site, and I urge you all to go to the NASA site, and you can see very fine detail of the impact zone of the Comet Tempel 1 before and after impact. What do you see here, Don? Show us what your eyes pick up.
Well, before the impact itself in 2005, there was a couple of things that could happen. If the slug, the copper slug that Tom was talking about, impacted it about 10 kilometers a second. That's 10 times faster than a bullet from a high-speed rifle. So either you create a bowl-shaped crater if you hit something fairly solid, a rocky body or a solid ice body, or you hit something much less dense and more porous, and it sort of swallows the slug. And that the latter is what happened. The crater that was formed was not the traditional bowl-shaped crater that we're used to seeing on the moon, but rather a subdued crater, very indistinct, with a central mound suggesting that we impacted something very soft and fluffy and fragile.
Soft and fluffy and fragile. Bob?
Yeah, I think I had heard something to the effect that the material that was flown off very gently settled back down, almost like material in water would settle into position because of the low gravity. Is this a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think it is, actually. That's precisely what happened. The central mound that I spoke of is thought to be material that was raised up, ejected as a result of the collision, but settled back down rather gently.
The other thing that I'm curious about is, from the Stardust images, are you guys going to be able to look at other parts of the comet to see how that is changed as it's passed close to the sun, you know, ejected material because of the heating up, and then because comets change over time because of their close approaches, and this is an opportunity to see how they change. And I'm wondering if Stardust has shown us any of that change besides the impact.
Well, there have been changes. One smooth area on the surface of the comet, there was two theories going into it. Either it's a sort of an avalanche phenomena where material is running downhill, or it's an icy scarp that is actually retreating as the ices vaporize and reveal the older subsurface materials. And the second set of images of that area that happened just a couple of weeks ago showed that it was, in fact, the latter. It was a retreating icy scarp. It wasn't an avalanche phenomenon. So, yeah, even over 6 years' time, there have been some dramatic changes on the surface.
Tom, what did we learn in this past, these photographs of Tempel 1 still being studied, that helps us better understand the makeup of this for the eventuality of having to divert one or deal with one?
I think looking at the traces of the crater that were formed by the deep impact strike back in 2005 tells us that these cometary bodies, if we have to divert a body like that, it's not likely to be a solid rocky body that can absorb an impact and then throw out ejecta in a rocket-like blast that will help us transfer momentum and change the velocity of the comet very efficiently. It's liable to absorb it. It's sort of like shooting a pillow with a BB gun. And the momentum might be absorbed by the comet, but you won't get as much ejecta effect to alter the comet's velocity.
It's like trying to push along a blob of mashed potatoes, I would think. It's not very cooperative. It might just break apart if you push it in one spot. Is that also a fair assessment?
Well, we might not find it very efficient in striking it with one hypervelocity slug, and it might require several. And, of course, comets are larger bodies than the typical asteroids that we might run into here on the Earth. So comets are going to be very tough, I think, to divert with some of the less energetic techniques. We might have to resort to explosives in the long run.
Don, this comet, Tempel 1, is this what we believe has hit the Earth before? Does this resemble one scenario for what hit the Yucatan Peninsula 65 million years ago?
It's fairly likely that impact 65 million years ago was in fact due to a 10-kilometer-sized comet. But it's also good to note that it's asteroids, really, that are the problem. They're far more numerous, 100 to 1 versus comets, but they're not nearly as large as the comets. So the big strikes may well be cometary, but the vast majority of the smaller strikes are asteroidal.
I want to say with the big one, Don, because I'm looking at this picture, it looks eerie and ominous, and if we said it was going to hit us, we'd have a lot to worry about. But you're giving us a picture of something that is a pile of diffuse material. But that was enough to destroy the shallow sea and scatter ejecta all over the Earth and leading to a mass extinction. Is that correct?
Well, yes, either a large asteroid or a large comet, one or the other, certainly impacted in the Chicxulub region of the Yucatan Peninsula.
Final question, Don. Do we have the capability of dealing with the Tempel 1 right now, or are we still learning how to deal with it?
Well, Tempel 1 is an object that's about 6 kilometers in size, so it would be one of the tougher objects to deal with. But as you get to smaller and smaller objects, and there's more and more of those, it's easier to deal with them with a kinetic impact that could be done easily if we find them early enough.
So, Tom, this is Tom Jones and Don Yeoman. Tom, we want to start with the small stuff and work up to the big ones. Is that it?
Yeah, we recommended, actually, Don and I were on a task force last fall that recommended to NASA that we do a technological demonstration of how to move a small asteroid from its orbit, to pick one that's innocuous, very far from the Earth, that has no chance of running into us, and then do the technological techniques like running into it at high speed or using a subtle gravity tractor spacecraft to tug gently over long periods of time on the object and show that we can actually do those kinds of precise orbital maneuvers and control. And that would give us a lot of confidence in dealing with an unexpected threat in the future.
Bob?
The question that comes to my mind, though, is to know, to do a mission like that, you have to characterize the asteroid or comet you're going to try to move first with some detail. Because, you know, if you choose a a gravity tractor versus to choose between a gravity tractor or a impact, you really need to know something about the asteroid itself, do you not?
Well, one nice thing about the gravity tractor, Bob, is that it doesn't really depend on the makeup of the object. You don't have to touch it. You don't have to land on it. All you have to do is hover nearby, and just the mutual gravitational tug between the spacecraft of a couple of tons and the asteroid will be enough to change the asteroid's velocity and make it miss its appointment with Earth a decade or more down the road. Now, if you do want to run into it and you want to transfer momentum efficiently and thus change the velocity, then you do have to know the characteristics of the surface material. And so it might require more than one mission to characterize and then actually divert an asteroid.
Well, do you have any preferences between using gravity versus an impact? Or from what you're saying and also what other things I've read, the idea of using gravity to slowly move an asteroid seems the most practical and safest approach.
It's the most precise because you can control the spacecraft and its distance above the asteroid for months or even years on end, and thus get exactly the right velocity change for having it miss its appointment with Earth in the future. And so that's the nice characteristic of it. And it doesn't require a touchdown or precise targeting as to where you strike the asteroid because you do never have to touch it. We've actually demonstrated gravity tractors, if you will, by flying interplanetary spacecraft to rendezvous with asteroids. And by getting it just a little bit more sophisticated, I think we could do a fairly good job with existing technology. But no one's ever tried to actually change the orbit of an object. The Tempel 1 impact, for example, in 2005 was a pinprick and had no effect really on the comet's velocity or trajectory at all.
Bob Zimmerman and I are speaking with Don Yeomans, Dr. Don Yeomans of JPL, and Tom Jones, a member of the Space Explorers Association. He's the representative, the chairman of the Near Earth Objects to the United Nations. And this is international cooperation at its best, dealing with the eventuality of a Near Earth object, comet or asteroid, inbound, and how do we move it over decades or generations in order to avoid a high probability of contact with the planet Earth. When we come back, what is to be done now? What's the immediate future of what we're learning from Tempel 1? What other missions are available to us to learn more about small objects and that 6-kilometer planet shaker called Tempel 1? I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. Bob Zimmerman and I are continuing with Don Yeomans of JPL and Tom Jones of the Space Explorer Association, both men tasked for meeting with the United Nations in preparation for a near-Earth object that threatens the Earth enough to move on it. Don, I'd like to ask right now, what are your immediate ambitions in your meeting in Europe and elsewhere? What do you need in order to better prepare after what we've learned from Tempel 1 and other sources?
Well, we have a pretty good start on finding the vast majority of these objects, and we've got to start on characterizing them. There have been some progress made on organizing the international community for missions that would deflect. What we haven't yet done, and what we need to do, is to get some sort of a international body to approve and sanction a mission should one be needed. So this is an international problem, requires an international solution, but the discussions within the United Nations Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space have just begun. So, but that process has begun. That's a step forward.
And Tom, go ahead, Tom.
Don's right. We have to get an international solution. It would be great to see an international demonstration mission in the next 5 to 10 years to show how some of these technologies could work. And in parallel with that, we should be doing joint exploration missions of nearby asteroids. I think one of the most promising candidates for an international collaboration would be to fund a space-based telescope, nothing like the Hubble, nothing as expensive as the Hubble, but something that's very modest but still can detect the vast majority of the small asteroids that really pose the biggest collision threat to us. We could find, for example, 90% of the objects that are about a soccer stadium or size or so, and these are the ones that run into us every few centuries or even more frequently. So that's the really prime objective, the really first step we should take towards protecting Earth, is to get a telescope up there that can really find the hazards, really find the exploration targets that astronauts might visit one day, too.
Bob?
Tom, you touched upon something I'd like to have a little bit more information on. The Congress mandated NASA to find 90% of all near-Earth objects that were about a soccer field in size and do it by 2020. Where do we stand on that goal? Have we found, or are we moving towards discovering 90% of all near-Earth object asteroids that are that size at this point? Where do we stand on that?
Now, we're a little behind on that category of objects. Don's program has done a good job on finding the big ones, the global threats to civilization, a kilometer in size and larger.
How many of those do we think we have at this point?
They're about 90% complete, 87%, and it's up to about 900 objects about a kilometer in size or larger. None of those happen to be headed for us anytime soon, which is good news. But for the smaller ones, we largely don't know about those at all. We only know of a few percent of the ones that form explosions like the one that happened in Tunguska in 2008. So, you know, that survey going down to 140 meters that the Congress mandated has not gotten underway just because the Congress has not given NASA the funds. And NASA said, you give us the money, we'll do the job. So far, those funds have not been forthcoming, even though the law is on the books.
Bob, you have a question about comets.
Well, the second point is, we're talking now near-Earth objects. These generally orbit along the elliptic. Is there any survey work done above the elliptic, looking outside that plane of the orbit of the solar system? Because there might even be asteroids, but comets often come from high inclinations. And so what kind of work's been done in that respect?
Don?
Well, actually, the surveys that are currently being funded by NASA do look above the ecliptic plane, although they spend most of their time looking in the ecliptic, where you'd expect most of the asteroids to be. And again, there are far more asteroids in near-Earth space than there are comets.
And so comets right now are an outlier to the program that we have going. Is that correct, John?
They're an outlier in the sense that they are far fewer of them, but
right.
On the other hand, if one was coming in from the very outermost solar system, they wouldn't show themselves till they got the orbit of Jupiter, and it would only take 9 months to get from Jupiter's orbit to the Earth's orbit. So the good news is that there's very few of them. The bad news is if a large one came in from the outer solar system, there's not a great deal we could do about it.
We've had some contact on Jupiter over the last years, I think most notably this last several months, of what are described as either asteroids or comets. Are those such things that coming in on this high inclination, or are those on the ecliptic, Don?
Well, those are typically on the ecliptic because they're striking Jupiter. They're probably short period comets that have been captured by Jupiter's gravity into the inner solar system and then have repeat encounters with Jupiter and thus get swept up by that large planet's gravity eventually. And we've been lucky enough by amateur detections and then following up with images from the Hubble and other big ground-based telescopes to find the impact scars in Jupiter's atmosphere from those objects. And, of course, that was the famous 1994 Shoemaker-Levy 9 impact that was the biggest one that we've observed. But we've seen other explosions similar to that the summer before last in 2009.
And, John, can we give NASA credit for arranging Jupiter as the flat catcher out there for the planet Earth?
Well, we owe somebody credit for putting Jupiter out there because Jupiter is, in fact, catching a lot of the material that might be headed toward Earth. So Big Brother Jupiter is doing a good job.
Bob, we have just 30 seconds left.
I'm just curious, what kind of, besides mission gravity tractor missions, what other kind of small telescope, what other kind of missions would you like to have them fund?
Tom?
Well, I think it's important to focus on the most practical and the most immediate technologies, and that would be the gravity tractor, and then try to hypervelocity kinetic impact, where we slam a massive satellite into an asteroid at high velocity.